Just did.
Competing points of view that you might have a row about. It's just a process of seeing whether things lead somewhere.
On the set, I mean, by virtue of the fact that having sort of written a script together, we're pretty much, I mean, we obviously share sort of the fundamental point of view about the material. On the set, if we're directing a scene, we're just both there. I mean,
hello from London, England. I'm Simon Collum.
From Toronto, Canada, I'm the Mad Hatter.
And welcome to the fourth Film Locker, whereby this week in the locker we've got no other than Joel and Ethan Coen, the Coen brothers themselves, to discuss.
They're a controversial choice, I'm sure. I believe that the Coen brothers are not everybody's cup of tea, but perhaps in 35 minutes or so we can change some minds. I think it might be a daunting task, sir, but I think it's a mission for this episode. If we have a mission statement, it's to see if we can change some minds.
Yeah, and at the same time, our choice of film for this episode, to kind of summarize the Coen brothers, is their best picture winner, No Country for Old Men. So if we're thinking about one which managed to kind of incorporate all the big Coen things and make it accessible to a wide, diverse audience, No Country for Old Men, I think it is a really good starting point to go for. Let's get stuck into the bio. Joel and Ethan Coen were born in 1954 and 1957, respectively, in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. It was a Jewish community, and their father, Edward, worked at the university. The connections to their 2009 film A Serious Man is evident in these small facts about their childhood. They moved into filmmaking after both brothers had completed a degree. Joel at New York University and Ethan at Princeton studying philosophy. Joel, who studied film, created a 30-minute thesis film called Soundings, which featured a woman engaged in sex with her deaf boyfriend while verbally fantasizing about having sex with her boyfriend's best friend, who was listening in the next room. After graduating from NYU, Joel worked on as a production assistant on a variety of industrial films and music videos. He developed a talent for film editing and met Sam Raimi, who was looking for an assistant editor on his first feature film, The Evil Dead. In 1984, the brothers wrote and directed Blood Simple, their first film together. Upon release, the film received much praise and won awards for Joel's direction at both the Sundance and Independent Spirit Awards. In 1985, they refined their writing skills further through Crime Wave, directed by Sam Raimi, whereby the Coens took joint credit for co-writers. Raising Arizona was released in 1988, starring Nicolas Cage. But it was the 90s that showed how important they were to American filmmaking. Beginning with Miller's Crossing, a gangster film noir in 1990, it was 1991's Barton Fink that garnered the brothers' critical acclaim, as the film won the Palme d'Or and Oscar nominations. Their success grew and grew, as after the misstep of the Hudsucker Proxy, they released Fargo, winning the Oscars for Frances McDormand and original screenplay for the Coens themselves. The cult comedy The Big Lebowski was the next film in 1998, which, well received by critics, seemed to gain more and more praise and became many people's favourite film. Not only a cult film, but also began a cult that includes Lebowski festivals and even a religious mantra which is based around the philosophical thoughts of the dude. Following a rocky time with Intolerable Cruelty and The Lady Killers, their success was firmly established at the Academy Awards in 2007, as No Country for Old Men won Best Picture. Since then, their success has been consistent, as A Serious Man and True Grit were both nominated for Best Picture, with Burn After Reading receiving more praise internationally, garnering nominations at the BAFTAs. Since 1984, the Coens have moved from promising talent through to being successful independent filmmakers, but then further to box office and solid critical acclaim, a balance that is very tricky to establish. The Coens have truly established the benchmark for all indie filmmakers and collaborators for the future.
Okay, so the thing is with the Coen brothers is that they're relatively quite new. I think the three directors we've discussed so far, David Cronenberg, Woody Allen, Martin Scorsese, they are, in fact, they've been around for, you know, 30 years, wasn't it, that you mentioned that Videodrome was from. And so we're talking directors who are really well established, whereas the Coen brothers are fairly new in that we're kind of going back to about roughly 1988, I think, was Blood Simple. Am I right? Or 84 was Blood Simple.
Yeah, 84 was Blood Simple. The Coen brothers are the first directors that we've talked about who weren't already working in the 70s. They're the first product of the 80s in this series.
And so with that in mind, what was the first Coen brothers film, Connor, you came in contact with?
My first experience with the Coen brothers is actually rather interesting. My first experience with the Coen brothers was in 1996. Fargo got all kinds of attention for Best Picture, and I rented it and watched it, and I loathed it. I hated it to the nth degree. I felt ripped off. $5 to rent it, and I felt ripped off. And so I didn't really get it, and I skipped right past The Big Lebowski, which was their next film. But then, eventually, I came back to Fargo, and I watched it again, and I watched it again, and it started to become really funny, and it started to become really, really profound and really, really dark, and I started to love it, and I went deeper and deeper into the Coen brothers' filmography.
I think for me, you see, I had like two kind of stop starts, which kind of, you know, my first real kind of point when I really was like, wow, they're brilliant, was No Country for Old Men, funnily enough. But prior to watching them, I did watch all of The Big Lebowski, and I thought, yeah, it's all right. I wasn't like, yeah, it's crazy funny. I think if I'm right, I think I watched it on my own. And I think it's one of those films, isn't it, where you watch it with other people, the laughter's that much stronger, much more toxic. And when you watch it on your own, you're especially for the first time, you'll be like, that's a bit weird. And the other one, which is a funny story, is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Whereby I was on a date with a girl, and we went around her house, and she had a few films, and she said, oh, which one should we watch? And she pulled out Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Just randomly, neither of us had seen it. And I said, oh yeah, you know, put it on. Obviously, we watched it, and it's all these kind of, these dusty landscapes, and Clooney, you know, singing, and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, yeah... Yeah, let's not watch this, because obviously I'm trying to woo her. I'm trying to be all, you know, charming and stuff, and I'm thinking this is not the film to be charming with. So we pulled it out, and to my embarrassment, what did we replace it with? What I was more comfortable watching was Save the Last Dance.
Oh, no. You are one smooth operator, you know? There's a...
Suffice to say, it didn't work. I mean, nothing ever happened that night. That was it. And maybe that was due to my appalling taste in film at the time. But, you know, anybody who listened to the Simon and Joe film show would have known that I've since then seen all of their films now. I've managed to go through the entire back catalogue and now right up the way to True Grit as well. So, you know, I absolutely love the Coen brothers. I think they're great.
Yeah, it's really funny because I find that Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, around the moment of your ill-thought wooing, was really where I latched on and started to really dig into their stuff more. And things after that, like The Man Who Wasn't There and certainly No Country for Old Men, I count myself now a big fan.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of their catalog, have you always kind of loved the style?
Well, no. That's the thing. Where I come to with Fargo is when I first watched them, I didn't really get it. I do know that there are a lot of people out there, and I mentioned this off the top, who actually don't like the Coen brothers. And while there are times where I will dig in my heels and tell people, watch it again, you know, try going this, I understand with the Coen brothers that they are a very, very particular brand of vodka. They are a very dry humor. They are a very absurd humor at times. And so while I appreciate it and it makes me laugh and so their films draw me in, I can understand how for some people that they don't really find it to their taste.
Well, I think, I mean, it's high praise for me to say, I think one of the Coen brothers' biggest influences, which is very clear, is Hitchcock. And I think his kind of stuff, I mean, things like the murder stories in No Country for Old Men and Blood Simple and even Barton Fink, I mean, they all have this kind of very quirky tone, which is similar to Hitchcock, because obviously Hitchcock himself had that whole balance between comedy with these kind of murder stories and this, you know, those type of things. And I think this is where it's very clear that the Coen brothers were influenced by that style. And I think if you do like Hitchcock and you like those type, especially his the more quirky ones, things like Rope, things like Dial M for Murder, you know, if you replace that kind of British side of things and you replace it with this kind of American, you know, Deep South type of thing, then you're getting closer to what the Coen brothers have kind of got. And I think, you know, that's high praise, but I think they've managed to really carve out a real niche, which, again, like the last three directors we discussed, this is unique. You know, you can tell what a Coen brothers film a mile off, their soundtrack, the look of it, the style of it, the actors. They look incredible every single time, and I think that's something which is the real credit to the Coen brothers.
Absolutely.
We're going to move into our main film now, and this one is obviously the Best Picture winner, No Country for Old Men.
Buenos dias. I'm guessing this isn't the future you had pictured for yourself when you first clapped eyes on that money. Don't worry, I'm not the man who's after you.
I know that. I've seen him.
You've seen him? Man, you're not dead.
Huh. What's this guy supposed to be, the ultimate badass?
No, I don't think that's how I'd describe him.
Well, how would you describe him?
I guess I'd say he doesn't have a sense of humor. His name's Sugar.
Sugar?
Sugar, Anton Sugar. You know how he found you?
Yeah, I know how he found me.
It's called a transponder.
I know what it's called. He won't find me again.
Not that way.
Not anyway.
Took me about 3 hours.
Yeah, well, I've been immobile.
No, you don't understand.
All right, so No Country for Old Men. This is a film starring Tommy Lee Jones, Javier Bardem in an Oscar-winning role, Josh Brolin, Woody Harrelson, and Kelly MacDonald. The story, and as I'm sure most people are well aware of, the central character is really Llewellyn Moss, played by Josh Brolin, and he finds these cars out in the middle of a desert with some money, and he takes that money, and Javier Bardem's Sugar, he's the guy who comes after him, amongst other people, whilst Tommy Lee Jones, his Ed Tom Bell, his deputy, or a sheriff, I guess, he's actually also trying to find out what's going on. So it's all based around this suitcase of money and who will end up with it. So that's really the kind of center point to that. What do you think of No Country for Old Men as a representation of the Coen brothers, Hatton?
Well, it's actually a very interesting representation of the Coens, because for my money, it's actually what they do best. They of course have become known for the quirky and for the offbeat humor, but they are really, really good at spinning a very, very gritty crime or like just very morally compromised story of people who are very, very damaged and find themselves into an impossible situation and how they decide to get themselves out of it. When you think of stories like this or their remake of True Grit or going all the way back to Blood Simple, they're really, really at their best when they're working with this kind of story. No Country for Old Men, you've got almost, I don't want to say an impossible situation, but they've taken this very difficult situation from the book by Cormac McCarthy of just happening upon a drug deal that's obviously gone very wrong, and hey, I'm going to take the money and I'm going to start going, but you don't really, you know, you don't count on who's going to come after you, and there's this cat and mouse thing that the Coens just do very, very well. Hey, I've got a question for you. Did you see No Country for Old Men in a theater?
I can't remember. Yes, I think it did.
Okay. Was your theater laughing at a lot of the lines?
I can't remember. I think yeah, I did see it at the cinema because I bought it myself when it came out. But I think there was a very, you know, it's that weird comedy, isn't it? Because it's like you've got this almost this Sugar is almost like one of those classic iconic characters akin to Hannibal Lecter when he's on the hunt, so he's doing these things, and that's really fascinating and really dark subject matter. But I think all the other, you know, people like Woody Harrelson's character, though he's in it for a short amount of time, there's a very tongue-in-cheek nature, I think, to all this.
Yeah, like, I think back to my audience when I saw this at the Toronto International Film Festival, and there were a lot of laughs to be had. It's very, very strange, because if you watch it, it seems to almost play it very straight, but it's dotted with these great moments of gallows humor, you know, in the way that that Llewellyn Moss speaks with it with Carla Jean, and in the moments, you know, that scene in the hospital between Llewellyn and Carson. It's very unexpected, but it plays so well.
You have got that comedy there, you know what I mean? Though you've got this great story, you're intrigued, you've got these great characters, that comedy is there. And a lot of that comedy comes into those very weird, very quirky characters. For example, the guy who's in who Shigur meets in that kind of off the road
petrol the gas station, yeah. The
gas station.
Colin, yes.
And that he's just a very strange character he doesn't, you know, what am I betting on? He doesn't know, you know, he doesn't understand it, but we do, and it's really, really dark and sinister, but I think it's that comedy which is just so well placed. I absolutely love that side of the Coen brothers, whereby they have that comedy. I mean, even again with True Grit, you know, you have got that comedy in Matt Damon's character throughout, and it's something they do very, very well.
This one was your choice. Why do you think it best sums up the Coen brothers' catalog?
Like I said, I think it's all about the setting, you know, in that desert landscape, that deep south of America. That's one thing. The comedy, the tone of the film, and at the same time, it's just glorious to look at. It's not small scale.
No.
I mean, if you think about things like Barton Fink, and we think about Fargo, they are very small scale. You know what I mean? They're small stories. I mean, Fargo, though it's on a large landscape, you've got a very small amount of characters and a very small group of people you're kind of following. With this one, only though it's a small group of people, you feel like it's so spacious. And that's something which I think is a great thing to see. When they have that space to play with, they do make it look incredible. And Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is another one whereby they have that space to play with and it looks stunning. And I think they've put a lot of what they've learned into this to make this film almost like I said, the perfect Coen Brothers film. I think that's why I chose it.
Yeah, you know, and my question was not to really dispute this choice as their essential film, because I think that, you know, if you are going to choose one Coen Brothers movie to represent them, this is certainly the choice. Because it's not that I think that it's their best film, but I actually believe that this is one of the very, very best films of the century so far. When I sat down to come up with the best films of the decade at the you know, at the dawn of 2010, I had this at number 3 of the entire decade, just behind Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and Good Night and Good Luck. This movie, it's got a bleakness to it that I think really, really summed up what a lot of us were thinking in the early decade. You know, the world was ensconced in two wars. We would go on to watch our economy just almost come to its knees, and there was a lot of pessimism and a lot of, like I say, a lot of gallows humor, a lot of really, really bleak humor going on. And I think I'm a deep, deep fan of the ambiguous ending and the questions that it leaves you asking. And Lord knows, if any of their films have an ambiguous ending, this is one, you know, that almost seems to just run out of film.
I mean, the whole point is obviously Shigur himself, you know, he's not following the rules, he runs a red light and inevitably gets into a crash. But what I think is very poignant is there is that argument with the kids about money. And that's the bottom line, is it about money, really? I mean, we've got this guy who's breaking the rules. It's about power. It's about, you know, I mean, I know Javier Bardem said that when he tried to create the character, he didn't think of a history. He didn't think of his parents or anything like that. He just said, I am personifying evil. I am personifying somebody who don't want to meet. And he was just putting that character into a person. But the reality is that there's that, you know, the whole Llewellyn Moss, he is after money. And yet he doesn't get it. And for what? And you kind of think this definition of success people are chasing after, that, you know, success is defined by your wealth, it's just not true. Whereas I think the sheriff, on the other hand, is somebody who has a family and he's seen some horrors, but he has the stuff which actually he defines as success.
Well, the other thing that's really, really dark about this film is, you know, is Shigur's tendency to give people an out by flipping a coin. You know, you think here is a killer who's being merciful, who's being fair, and then it occurs to you, wait a second, this is not fair at all. This is no, you know, this is no secret back door out of this situation. This is still every bit as terrifying and every bit as horrible as if he just walked up to you and shot you randomly. He's bargaining with you for your own life. And it was so unexpected at the time that it came out in 2007. And it really, the whole film with its violence, its wit, its helplessness of, you know, of just trying to run away, of, as the tagline goes, of trying to stop what's coming, really, really seemed to encapsulate what the early part of this century was about for a lot of people.
No, I definitely think so. Anyway, I think now we've kind of ripped No Country for Old Men into shreds. I think at the same time, to finish that, you obviously prefer No Country for Old Men to There Will Be Blood, I guess. Because at the time of the Oscars, when No Country for Old Men won, the two were up against each other. And I've got to tell you, I think There Will Be Blood kind of had the edge.
I think that we might have to save that for our Paul Thomas Anderson conversation.
Just the talking point.
But it is.
Have that ready on the blog. Discuss that. There Will Be Blood had the edge. But anyway, we're not talking about Paul Thomas Anderson. We're talking about the Coen brothers, and we're going to be talking about their back catalogue after this break. Okay, so we've mentioned a lot of the back catalogue and about where they came from. And I think now's the opportunity to maybe go through some favourites, some not-so-favourites. Very quickly, Hatter, your not-so-favourite one.
My not-so-favourite one is what I call their studio pictures. There was a moment during the middle of the decade where it felt like they sold out, to use a very cliché term. And back-to-back, they did Intolerable Cruelty in 2003 and The Lady Killers in 2004. And they almost came across like hired guns. They came across like studio pictures that said, hey, let's get the Coen brothers to direct this. This will be right up their alley. And it, for me, these two films back to back really don't work.
I know. I would agree with you. So I think if we're saying one each, you can have Lady Killers. I'll have Intolerable Cruelty, because I mean, I think they are quite clearly, there's something missing. But I say that, but I haven't got such a big problem with The Lady Killers. And I think with Intolerable Cruelty, as much as I think it, I know what you mean about that studio feel to it. But I think to myself, in fact, that they've kind of, they just kind of missed the target, really. Because I think, especially with Intolerable Cruelty, you can see there is this very kind of trying to go for, you know, the golden age kind of comedies with like His Girl Friday and Bringing Up Baby and those kind of Cary Grant and those type of characters, which they're trying to bring into these films of these very up-to-date, you know, in 2003, for God's sake. And I think, unfortunately, it just doesn't seem to pull it off. I mean, for one, I mean, I think California kind of looks quite cheap in how they shoot it. And maybe that's the point, but it doesn't seem to really work. And Zeta-Jones is this very kind of like cold character. And I just, you know, it's just not nowhere near as much fun as if you think about the women back in the 40s. You think about Katharine Hepburn and you think about, was it Rosalind Russell was in His Girl Friday?
I think so.
But you think about those women. I mean, they oozed this kind of femininity and this control, and yet they were playful. And you could see they had the men in the palm of their hands. Now, Clooney, I've always felt, is like, you know, definitely the modern-day Cary Grant.
Or, absolutely.
And he was fine. I didn't think he had a problem in terms of his role. It was well cast. I just don't think Zeta-Jones had the kind of pizzazz that she needed to bring to the role. And there was a problem in that. But I really disliked it. It felt really difficult to watch. And it just went nuts towards the end. And you just kind of, I just missed a lot of what happened towards the end. But I thought Lady Killers wasn't too bad. I think, you know, you're taking an Ealing Brothers film, a very popular Ealing Studios film, and then you're turning it into, and you're making it up to date with Tom Hanks in the lead role. I mean, that just sounds cheap. You know what I mean? Like you're ripping something off. But I think, in all fairness, Hanks done a good job. He's got an incredible soundtrack, and you know, and that and it had, and obviously that Mrs. Munson She was great. She was brilliant.
Well, the funny thing is, I find that because it's their first remake, I think it's the rough draft for what they were able to do with True Grit. Now, of course, they're two totally different subject matters. When you're remaking an Alec Guinness film versus when you're remaking a John Wayne film, but if you're going to do a remake, I've had lots and lots of conversations on remakes. Of course, I think there is something that can be done. As a music fan, I'm not saying that nobody should ever cover another artist's song. I think you can certainly bring your own voice to a previous film. But I don't really know what they were trying to do with The Lady Killers versus what they did with True Grit that I think was more what they should have been trying to do, in taking the previous material and telling it their own way, telling it in a different way versus The Lady Killers, which I don't think they took quite far enough.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I like True Grit. I felt like it missed something grander about it. I don't know what it was. I mean, I liked True Grit a lot. I thought it had, like I said, I feel that the Western genre is where the Coen brothers have been leading to. And the fact that they've done a Western now, I'd like to think this is the start of a phase which they can continue with. But at the same time, I mean, I feel like the story of True Grit was so small in its scale about this revenge story. You kind of wanted it to be a bit more all-encompassing. I mean, another film which I really liked was Burn After Reading. that's obviously got all these, it's like this ensemble film with all these different characters and all these different things going on. And it's difficult to, and it's got a nice little, talking point about, about surveillance.
Yeah.
And about people who, who's watching the people who are watching who else and all that type of thing. And it's so funny because when you actually see the ludicrous idea that, they're tapping our phones. I mean, it's like, it doesn't, even if they were, how on earth would they manage such a thing? It's ridiculous. And it is laughable. And that's what was so great about Burn After Reading. And I kind of think that kind of ensemble story with lots of different characters would have been great to see in a Western. I think it was quite small scale, True Grit, and I think it could have been a little bit grander. That's just me.
Perhaps. One last thing I'd say before we move on, because I think we're sort of talking the Coen brothers to death. But as I mentioned off the top, I have met other film bloggers and other film lovers who have told me, I really don't like the Coen brothers. I don't really buy into them. And I'm not here to argue whether somebody should love the Coen brothers or not, because they're, as I mentioned off the top, they are a very particular taste. What I would offer, though, and this will actually come up in our next episode as well, is there is an order. There's a running order in which, if you're going to come into the Coen brothers films, you should kind of understand. So if somebody were to just dive into the Coen brothers for, wanting to get an appreciation for their film, if they start with A Serious Man from 2009, they're up a creek without a paddle, because that is not the entry point. That is actually very, very Coen brothers for Coen brothers lovers. It's one of the last films you should watch, not because it's bad, but just because it falls that far down their little rabbit hole. I would say the entry point is more films like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which we're going to talk about in a moment or two, The Big Lebowski and No Country for Old Men. Those are the films you should start with. Another one that you might be starting off wrong is, as much as I think people love it, Raising Arizona, again, is not the entry doorway into their canon, again, because it's just so very absurd.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with it. Okay, to the top shelf.
Well, mine from the top shelf, we mentioned a few times, is from 2000. It's Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, George Clooney, Tim Blake Nelson, John Turturro, Holly Hunter. The list just goes. It's got that wonderful Roger Deakins photography, making the Depression era South look so faded and worn and poor. It's got the glorious soundtrack. It's got songs that'll get stuck in your head for weeks for good reason. And it is so, so funny. I could quote this movie endlessly. We could do an entire Film Locker episode of just me reciting Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. I think our listeners might like that, actually.
Maybe.
if, if, if,
we could at least have the soundtrack playing. That's not a problem.
I'm sure. I think if you listen closely, you'll hear hundreds of people screaming "No!" in unison right there to the prospect of me just quoting "O Brother, Where Art Thou?" for an entire episode. But the reason why this is my top shelf choice is because, as I've mentioned, this is the entry point. This is the one you should start with. For its humor, for its look, for its overall patois to the speech. It's such a wonderful story, and it's so accessible.
You say it's accessible. I chose Save the Last Dance.
Well, I'm not suggesting it for methods of seduction. You know, I'm suggesting it for a night of film watching. That would be my choice for the top shelf. Because it was my first real foray into really loving the Coen Brothers.
Okay, my top shelf choice is The Man Who Wasn't There from 2001. And this is a film which I think is vastly underrated. When people talk about the Coen Brothers, they mention Your Big Lebowski and No Country for Old Men and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And to be honest, they rarely mention The Man Who Wasn't There. And I think it's one of their best films. I mean, it really has the look of it is so different to all their other ones. It's shot exclusively in black and white, and it's got a really great, beautiful tone to it with these sharp uses of light and whatnot, and it looks incredible. Billy Bob Thornton is the lead role. He's Ed Crane, this barber who's got a wife played by Frances McDormand who sleeps around a little bit, and so you've got, again, like I mentioned before, this very Hitchcock kind of tale of the woman who's having an affair and the husband who then kills the lover of his wife. And yet it's not as simple as that. I think when we think about Pulp Fiction, everybody talked about how what's so good about Pulp Fiction is that it gets these very cliche setups and then completely twists them on their head. So and it's exactly the same here, that you've got this setup of the cheating wife, and yet it completely throws it on its head. It's also got Scarlett Johansson in it, and never a bad film that she's in. The film itself might be bad, but the fact that she's on screen, that's all I'm happy with. That's fine for me. And then Richard Jenkins is in it as well, and Tony Shalhoub, so you've got a lot of regular collaborators who worked with the Coen Brothers before as well. But definitely, definitely, The Man Who Wasn't There is my one from the top shelf, which I would recommend as soon as you've watched one, put this one in next, definitely.
It, you're right. It is very, very underrated. We didn't mention James Gandolfini. This is kind of just when he was breaking out as Tony Soprano. He's awesome in this film as Big Dave Brewster. But yeah, Tony Shalhoub always gives me a grin as Freddy Riedenschneider. There's a name for the ages. The fast-talking lawyer who comes in and tries to help Ed Crane. Also, the thing I love about this film is I think every film out there is automatically that much better when Billy Bob Thornton is doing a deadpan voiceover.
Yeah, I know, I can agree with that. And to be honest, if we go back to Intolerable Cruelty, where Billy Bob Thornton is in a small role in that, I mean, it's probably the best thing about the film, is when Billy Bob Thornton is playing this kind of, I think it's like a Texas millionaire or something, and he's only in it for a short amount of time. But Billy Bob Thornton is one of these actors who, if the Coen Brothers were to make another film with Billy Bob Thornton, that would be a damn good thing.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we've got our trivia questions coming up after this. To be lies, know the joy within you. Okay, so we have some great music there to listen to from some of the Coen Brothers soundtracks, but we've also now got the trivia, so a few questions to think about and even get in contact with us about, so you can actually be in with a chance to get a Blu-ray or a DVD. Okay, three questions from Hatter. What are they?
Well, my questions go like so. Which actress is married to Joel Coen? Joel and Ethan often edit their own films. What's the alias that they edit their films under? And finally, name the 2009 Chinese film that is a remake of Blood Simple.
Nice, nice questions. My three is, first one is, what is the lowest grossing Coen Brothers film mean, they're directors who often their films, you know, and at some points didn't get as much money as people predicted. But there's one specific one which is quite renowned for being their lowest grossing film. The second question is, which Sam Raimi film did Joel Coen work on as editor? This is one of these little things which got them right into the business early on, but it was a Sam Raimi film that Joel Coen worked on. Which one was it? And then the last question is something I just found out, which is Roger Deakins, who's worked with the Coen brothers for many, many years, which franchise film is he working on at the moment to be released in 2012? It's a franchise film. It's a big, big film, and I cannot believe this guy is going to be doing the cinematography to it, but it is confirmed. So that's my final question. Which film is Roger Deakins working on at the moment?
We'll see. We got some tough ones there this episode, sir.
I think so. But obviously, you can obviously have a gander on the internet or just get involved and just make sure you get those results off to us. Obviously, the email is filmlocker@hotmail.com.
You can also get in touch with us by reading the blog, thefilmlocker.blogspot.com.
And obviously, we have our own blogs. My one's at screeninsights.blogspot.com.
And mine is The Dark of the Matinee at mickyneilmatinee.blogspot.com.
Okay, so we'll be up for a fifth Film Locker next week, and we'll see if that director might, again, be somebody who's going to help us out to learn more about the old cinema.
It's a little bit of a controversial choice, but here's hoping that it can provide for some entertainment. So until then, we'll see you next week.
Okay, and goodbye from me.